This week's After Dinner speaker is our international relations specialist, working as an assistant professor of that subject at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. She was based at the institution's campus in Italy, but the last time we spoke, she was a COVID-19 refugee in Germany. Whether she's in Germany, Italy, or Aotearoa, we're about to find out. What I can confirm for you right now is she's edited a book on this nation's relationship with the world called Beyond These Shores. Kia ora, Nina. Welcome back to Nights.
Kia ora, Brian. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. Where are you right now?
I am indeed back in Berlin, although I can confirm I was able to cross the borders in Europe over to Bologna last week. I got the train, the night train, which is a lovely way to travel, waking up just outside of Venice. And the borders are easier to cross than they were last time we talked.
Are you back teaching?
No, we get back in September, and it's interesting because we're one of the few campuses at Johns Hopkins that will have some live and present teaching, as in students in a classroom, because in the US they've decided many universities, including Harvard, including my other colleagues in DC, that they will be only teaching online because of course, of the COVID pandemic.
Now, one of the first things that struck me about the book you've edited, Beyond These Shores, is the diversity in the writers. Tina Nata, Zheng Dajing, Tulia Thompson, and you've even got Thomas Nash in there, who's a current cabinet minister. I'm guessing you're keen to get a greater range, that's me waving the book around and banging the microphone, by the way, more input, a more diverse input into how we discuss this topic.
I am indeed, and it is a very diverse lineup. I'll make one small correction. Thomas Nash isn't yet a cabinet minister. I'm sure he'd be delighted
that you elevated him to that.
He's currently a regional councillor in Wellington.
Oh, good grief. I'm getting him mixed up with the other Nash.
Yes,
the grandson of Walter Nash.
Thomas Nash,
that's right. He's a Green Party. He's regional council. Sorry about that, Thomas, if you're listening.
I'm sure he won't have any problem. So, yes, he's a councillor. And to give your readers a bit of an idea about this book, which came out on Monday with Bridget Williams' books, it's something I've been working on for a couple of years with a diverse range of writers, of researchers, of activists. And the idea behind it was really to get inject a bit more diversity into debates about New Zealand's role in the world. Because so often, and this isn't just in New Zealand, unfortunately, how we think about foreign policy is dominated by sort of acronyms, by faraway places, by international summits that most people will never get to, whether it be APEC or the climate summit. And the idea is to say, actually, there's a lot about our relationship with the world that's also about people-to-people relations, it's about business. And so the authors that I selected and have worked with in the last 2 years were very much a reflection of that. So people like Tina Ngata, who lives up on the East Coast, who's written a lot about plastic pollution and what in this chapter in the book she talks about waste colonialism and has done a lot of work around decolonization and Māori rights. Tulia Thompson, another of the writers who you can read. I would recommend you read an excerpt on Air Tangata, which just came out yesterday of her book, as a creative writer who also worked with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Trade. And Tulia did a PhD at the University of Auckland on sexualities in the Pacific, and has a great take, both from a very personal, deep view on her relationship with Fiji. Her father was Fijian and her mother Pākehā. And going home to her other home, she mostly grew up in New Zealand, and reflecting on what she talks about as coral consciousness, this idea of how New Zealand needs to listen much closer to the Pacific. And I can go on about her chapter and any of them, but I think what I'm really excited about with this book is that there's so many different and interesting insights from a very diverse group of people.
Well, these things often do affect us. We might not think they do, but they come up. You've just talked about our relationship with the wider Pacific. Now, right now, New Zealand's grappling with whether it opens or extends its bubble, its COVID bubble, out to some of those Pacific Island nations, including the Cook Islands. And the government seems to be moving rather slowly on that, and maybe that's because it's been lobbied by the New Zealand tourism sector not to open up too quick so New Zealanders don't scuttle off there and spend their money in the Cooks. But I think from the other side of that, which is not something I've heard much, which is if New Zealand wants to strengthen its relationship with these nations, maybe it might be a good idea for us to think about that a bit sooner than we currently are.
Yeah, I mean, I can't comment on the current proposals because I'm not privy to information about, you know, what are the health concerns on both sides, which I can imagine are great, as well as obviously economic interests. And I did read something short this morning that was suggesting in the Cook Islands it was the international hotels that were keen to kickstart the tourist industry in the Cook Islands. But I think the more general point that some of the authors in our book point out is that New Zealand has had a long relationship with many of the Pacific Islands. I mean, the Cook Islands, Samoa, Tokelau, Niue have a colonial relationship also with New Zealand that not many New Zealanders are that aware of. You know, Western Samoa, and interestingly, sitting in Germany, it's interesting because Western Samoa was part of the German late colonization, as was Papua New Guinea and as was Namibia. And what happened at the end of World War One when Germany lost is that these got passed on to West Samoa to New Zealand, Papua New Guinea to Australia, and Namibia to South Africa. And so New Zealand was, you know, its own form of a colonial power. And this is something Tulia points out very strongly in her chapter about needing to recognize the harm done in too many Pacific Island nations during that period and ongoing, because, you know, it wasn't all positive. She talks a lot about the sort of extractive nature of colonialism, how, and I quote her, she says, "We took cheap phosphate for decades, which fed the grass in New Zealand to become meat and wool," and highlights this practice of resource extraction. So I think one of the things she talks about very strongly in her chapter, which again I'd recommend obviously to buy the book, but for all of those who want to get on and read it straight away, you can read an excerpt of Tulia's work on the E Tangata website, which I can hand on to you, Brian, and you feel free to share with your listeners. And I think we need to have more conversations about our relationship, all of the dimensions of our relationship with the Pacific.
Tina Nata, what does she mean by waste colonialism?
Yeah, thanks for picking up on that. And I mean, with all of these writers, I'd recommend that you talk with them as well. Obviously, I'm representing their work here, but they have equally strong voices that should be heard directly from them. So Tina's chapter talks about waste colonialism, whereby essentially industrialization, which was mostly obviously in the West, has polluted oceans and waterways. And what we often see is developed countries exporting their waste to less developed states, just like we see in New Zealand with, we have for some time exported our waste to Asian countries. Mm.
Which are actually now starting to say maybe they don't want it so much now.
Correct. And that, you know, brings other issues for New Zealand to think about what we're going to do with our waste. And so this is, I think, a lot of New Zealanders and a lot of your listeners are very concerned about the state of our rivers, of our oceans, wanting to be able to swim in them again, concerned about the impact on wildlife. And in fact, Tina in her chapter says how she herself went on to have a year without plastic after she saw what plastics were doing to albatrosses, the Lycan albatross, which were dying in hundreds of thousands through ingesting plastic. And I think for her, one of the big parts of the solution is actually to involve Indigenous people in the decision-making and to say, you know, Māori, and other peoples of the Moana, other Indigenous peoples across the Pacific, have for decades coexisted with the Moana, with the ocean, and have found ways to live sustainably. And we have ambitious goals at the UN level, the UN Sustainable Development Goals. And what we should be doing is trying to involve Indigenous people more in those discussions about global environmental governance.
Since we last spoke, Nina, the global situation appears to have become, especially on either side of the Pacific Ocean, a bit more confrontational. I'm talking about the United States and China. And New Zealand, well, I guess one of the issues that maybe we face is which way do we go in that? I mean, the United States is a problematic ally at the moment, if that's what they are. And China, kind of, some of China's activities make me feel deeply uncomfortable as well.
For sure. And I think that's one of the dominant debates in international relations today is this increased tension between China and the US and what's going to happen. I should point out that there's also a lot that will play out according to what happens in the US election in November. You know, people are saying if Biden comes to power, will things change? It's an interesting question that no one really knows, first of all, whether he will become the US president, although a lot are pinning their hopes on that. And I think another element of it is if you read what I've seen of his foreign policy stances so far, is he's still quite strongly suspicious and even potentially anti-China. In fact, I can quote him. He says, "The US does need to get tough with China. If China has its way, it will keep robbing the US and American companies of their technology and intellectual property." That was a piece he wrote back in March. So I think what's interesting is that there is a sense that even if Biden was to be elected president of the US, the US's position will probably change somewhat, but not completely. And that leaves interesting questions for where New Zealand situates itself. And as far as I know, all of the major parties have said that we want to continue to have a very strongly independent foreign policy, which means neither siding too closely with the US or China.
Is New Zealand too dependent on trade with China to actually really run the risk of being critical of some of its actions, say the way at the moment it appears to be shutting down human rights in Hong Kong?
Yeah, it's a tricky balancing act. And I think New Zealand does have a very strong trading relationship with China. But just in the weekend, New Zealand came out, of course, with its other, the Anglo alliance of Britain, Canada, the UK, and the US, the Five Eyes Alliance, criticizing Hong Kong and implicitly China about not holding their council elections soon enough as planned, and also arguing that pro-democracy candidates should stand. New Zealand, of course, has also signaled the end of its extradition treaty with Hong Kong, partly because of this new national security law. So I think what I have seen thus far is an attempt to try and both continue economic relations with China, as well as trying to criticize what is perceived as very problematic human rights and democracy stances. In the book, what we've done is we have a chapter from Zheng Dazheng. He's a Chinese-born, now New Zealand citizen, and he's a really interesting take on the China and New Zealand relationship. And what he argues is that we shouldn't be having this debate on these terms of China versus the US, but rather focusing on solidarity with Chinese people. So actually the citizens in China who are losing out due to growing income inequality and what he calls increasing Han nationalism. Han is the majority ethnicity in China.
Yeah.
And as he states, we must stand with the ethnic minorities who are increasingly under the pressure of great Han chauvinism and the Han people who, being enticed and driven to Tibet, Xinjiang, and elsewhere, have also become caught in the nightmare of the China dream. And so I think that's a really interesting take, is to get us away from maybe thinking about this great geopolitics between, you know, diplomats in Beijing and in Wellington and DC, and thinking about, well, who are the people that are living there? How are they feeling about the current regime in China?
And how does one do that in a way that's constructive in a little country like New Zealand?
Yeah, I mean, it's a fair question. And he has some really interesting takes on this. He says, we need poets and novelists here and there and elsewhere to tackle the alienating consequences of modern capitalism. That's a direct quote from him. We need to propose alternative ways to live well, remembering that the Chinese revolutionary spirit during the first half of the 20th century owes much to a new literary movement. So he would point also to these ideas, and I think this is very much in the spirit of the book overall, is to say, what are the ways that we as individuals can connect, whether it be through writing or music, through social movements, through other forms of connection, that not everything in our relations with the world has gone through government in the past and should go through government in the future. So foreign policy is one element of our relationship with the world, but the book is saying we have a much broader set of relationships that go beyond our shores.
I worry a bit, and okay, this is just a personal opinion, but which is, at the moment, in terms of democracies in some of the most powerful English-speaking countries, UK and USA, and maybe in some parts of Europe that don't speak English, democracy seems to be struggling a little bit. And I worry about where that will lead us in the next 10 or 20 years and what relationship, what countries we need to or could be focusing a stronger relationship with that share some of our values.
Yeah, and that is a theme that very much comes out in Max Harris's chapter. Some of you will be familiar with Max Harris, who wrote The New Zealand Project a few years back. And his chapter asks these questions about reconsidering our traditional alliances and pointing out some of the challenges today with both the US and the UK, who think it's pretty easy and clear cut to say that they really didn't grasp initially the scale of the COVID crisis and did not subsequently manage the situation effectively for their own citizens, let for the world. You know, both the US and the UK see themselves as great world powers and they can't even manage the COVID crisis domestically. So Max Harris in his chapter questions the merits of staying in the Five Eyes Alliance and says, why, you know, do we really have common values with a lot of these other countries in the current world order? And I think it is an open question. Of course, one of the tricky things about forming alliances with other countries is that you're very dependent on what happens domestically in terms of the elections, right? So you might have two leaders who see themselves in a similar political ideological stance, but then it can change, of course, as we saw from Obama to Trump. And the question, of course, now, does it go Trump to Biden? And what will that mean if we have a Biden presidency? Will that dramatically change the way the US interacts with the world?
I guess that's something we'll find out over the next 6 months or so, whether we even have a change, of course. We don't know that yet, as you point out, Nina.
Exactly.
Nina, thank you so much for joining us. I hope you get back to Italy soon and start teaching again. Although you could well be enjoying Berlin.
Berlin is a lovely place, I can tell you, in summer. There's lots of swimming happening and lakes and camping, and it's, no major complaints here for the time being.
Thanks so much for your time, Nina, and good luck with the book.
Thanks, Brian. Thanks so much.
Thank you. That's Nina Hall from Johns Hopkins University. She's normally teaching on their campus in Bologna, currently in Berlin. Her book is called Beyond These Shores, well, the one she edited, Altera in the World. It's published by BWB Texts.